Welcome back, Question Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. By now, you all know the deal. It is time to get into the literature that I'm talking about. It has been, it's been just over 10 days. I've been gone. Not gone doing nothing, but gone talking about cholesterol. Oh, yes, that is right. Talking about cholesterol, my friends, and there will be multiple cholesterol breakdowns, if you will, coming up in the near future. Not yet, not going to happen just quite yet, but we're going to be talking about evidence, because if I can tell you in the last 10 days how many times I heard somebody say, well, we should write guidelines that say this, because the AHA and the ACA, they say this. And when you go and look at the actual evidence that the American Heart Association used, you find, it's a little sketch. They're making a little bit of a reach based on their primary evaluation of the literature. At least that's my take on it. Anyways, I don't want to give it all away too soon. I just want to encourage all of you, before we dive into this podcast, to please critically think about everything that you read, because that expert opinion is really just an expert opinion. They are just a physician, just a provider, and they're sitting in a room, likely because some drug company gave them a lot of money to sit in a room with their quote, unbiased opinion and $1 million sitting in their back pocket. I don't know any of that to be true. I can just tell you what I know to be told. So, without further ado, we have rambled on too long. Let's get into this podcast show. Here we go. Without any further ado, without any further reservation, without any more hesitation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2019. Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. This podcast is a good one, I think, because it talks all about antiplatelets. Now, I know in 2018, I crushed antiplatelets, particularly aspirin. Oh, yes, the three trials that came out that destroyed aspirin for primary prevention. And I also said, this is over, this is done. We should no longer be giving aspirin. But aspirin's not dead, and there are at least certain situations where it is pretty darn good. It is no more likely seen than in this trial, straight out of the New England Journal of Medicine, May 16, 2019, dabigatran, prevention of stroke after embolic stroke of undetermined source. You see, here's the problem. You have an embolic stroke, and we don't know where it came from. It's an unknown source, but we do know that there are a lot of, quote, unknown sources that probably come from AFib. We can just never detect them. So maybe, just maybe, if we gave them dabigatran, a true anticoagulant compared to aspirin, a true normal standard of care antiplatelet, after embolic stroke, maybe they would do better on the dabigatran. Well, they convinced just over 5,000 patients to join this trial that had a unrecognized or unfounded non-lacunar ischemic stroke. They followed up for 19 months, and at 19 months, there, statistically speaking, was really no difference in the rate of recurrent stroke, so that would be a wash, if you will. However, believe it or not, there was more bleeding with the major anticoagulant. That's right. The non-major bleeding was significantly more common with dabigatran, 2.6 versus 1.5. Those of you playing along at home, that's a 1% absolute difference, which means a number needed to harm of approximately 100. Aspirin has been around forever, and it amazes me that it is still our go-to after an ischemic stroke. To this day, it is still pretty darn good as what it does. And we have all this new technology and all these fancy things, and aspirin still seems to be king when you have an ischemic stroke of unknown origin. And they often say, when it rains, it pours. And let me tell you, aspirin didn't stop there with its many victories. And that is clearly shown in the RESTART collaboration, the effects of antiplatelet therapy after stroke due to intracerebral hemorrhage, RESTART, a randomized open-label trial. Here's the deal. When someone has an intracerebral hemorrhage, the question is, what do you do? What do you do when they all of a sudden start bleeding in their brain? Well, this study in the UK took just over 500 adults who had a spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage. They just spontaneously started bleeding in their brain. Talk about a really bad day. these 530-some patients were all taking either antiplatelets or anticoagulation drugs. They then were held on their medication for 2 to 3 months, roughly, and then either restarted on their antiplatelet, aspirin or clopidogrel, or they were instructed to avoid it. They then followed them up for 2 years and said, what was the recurrence rate of intracerebral hemorrhage? You would think, because I'm telling you this, that there's going to be no difference. And there was no difference, statistically speaking. It was 4% in the antiplatelet group and 9% in the control group, which had a p-value of 0.06. I've talked about it on Question Medicine before, but the p-value of 0.06 is so close to this magical made-up number of 0.05 that you could almost say there was benefit there. Now, it's not totally plausible how taking aspirin would prevent you from having an intracerebral hemorrhage that was spontaneous previously or recurrent ones, but it is there, and you can say, oh, wow, maybe there is something there. Although, there definitely was something there, at least statistically speaking, when they did the follow-up of the secondary endpoint. The secondary endpoint was non-fatal myocardial infarction, non-fatal stroke, or vascular death, 17% versus 24%, p-value 0.03. That reached statistical significance and clinical significance, that if you had a spontaneous bleed in your brain, if you were restarted on aspirin 2 to 3 months later, you did better at 2 months of follow-up. I love this trial because it tells us we can restart aspirin. Let's say that patient that has a stroke then has a spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage. That is great to know. 2 to 3 months later, boom, restart the aspirin. What this does not tell us is, what about the patients that are on anticoagulation? What do we do with them? It didn't look at that, and I wish that it would have. But at least we know antiplatelets, if they have a stroke, let's say maybe they get a stent in their heart, you can restart on their antiplatelets. And speaking of stenting, let's go on to the next article. Now, I know in the last article, or before the last article, I said when it rains, it pours, but actually, in Florida, when it rains, it might be a hurricane. And again, this is shown in this aspirin or antiplatelet trial called the Smart Choice Randomized Clinical Trial. This is JAMA, June 25th. This was the effect of P2Y12 inhibitor monotherapy versus dual antiplatelet therapy on cardiovascular events in patients undergoing PCI. Here's what they did. They took 3,000 patients that undergo PCI, and then they randomized them to dual antiplatelet therapy for 3 months or for 12 months. And you might be saying to yourself, wow, self, that's very interesting, because I know that the current guidelines recommend dual antiplatelet therapy for at least 6 months. So now we're going down to 3 months, comparing it to 12? OMG, what are we going to find? Well, the primary endpoint was all-cause mortality, myocardial infarction, or stroke at 12 months. And wouldn't you know it, the difference between 3 months and 12 months, it was 2.9% versus 2.5%. No statistical difference between them. And if I told you that the rate of bleeding was different between 3 months of dual antiplatelet therapy and 12 months of antiplatelet therapy, you probably wouldn't be surprised. And that's because the rate of all bleeding was lower with 3 months of dual antiplatelet therapy. Surprise, surprise, but they didn't just stop there. Oh no, no they did not. You see, they moved on to the STOP-DAPT-2 randomized trial. This was effective 1 month dual antiplatelet therapy followed by clopidogrel versus 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy on cardiovascular and bleeding events in patients receiving PCI. You heard it correctly in the title, 1 month of dual antiplatelet therapy versus 12 months of antiplatelet therapy. Now, I know 1 month may not seem like very much, and maybe we're just going to get down to the point at some point when we just do 1 week, or maybe one day, or maybe we just lick the dual antiplatelet therapy. We just look at it, and that seems to have equal benefit here. But let's dig into this trial. See, they had just over 3,000 adults who underwent a PCI with a drug-eluting stent. And then before the hospital discharge, they randomized patients to 1 month of dual antiplatelet therapy, followed then by clopidogrel monotherapy for up to 5 years, or you were randomized to dual antiplatelet therapy with aspirin and Plavix for up to 12 months, then followed by aspirin monotherapy for up to 5 years. Primary endpoint that they were looking for was a composite of cardiovascular death, myocardial infarction, stent, thrombosis, stroke, or bleeding. If we're just looking at 12 months, they had near 100% perfect follow-up. This was an ideal study. And wouldn't you know it, at 1 month, dual antiplatelet therapy was both significantly non-inferior, but also superior to 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy for the primary composite endpoint that I just mentioned, 2.36 versus 3.7%. That is a number needed to treat of 76. And you might say to yourself, well, I am sure that there was a number needed to harm, because I am sure that those individuals who were on dual antiplatelet therapy for 12 months had more bleeding events than those that were only on it for a month, and you would be correct. Oh, yes. The bleeding events, 0.41 versus 1.54. That's a number needed to harm of 116. So 1 month of dual therapy, then followed by Plavix for up to 12 months, or up to 5 years, but up to 12 months, compared to dual antiplatelet therapy for a full 12 months, it looks like indeed we are there. It's time. Game changing. Here it is. This is the article you should try to remember from this podcast, because it will change your practice. And that is dual antiplatelet therapy 1 month, then only Plavix for the next 11. It not only had a number needed to harm that was beneficial and superior, it had a number needed to treat that was superior and beneficial. This is game changing. But I imagine, despite the evidence, there is still going to be a wide variation of practice that will be seen in clinical practice. Certain cardiologists are going to say, I know that this 1 month is superior to 12 months, but I don't believe that trial. I think it's actually 6 months. I think it's 12 months. There will be varying practice patterns until the guidelines, or there is a current standard of the way it should be done. Now, this current standard or wide variation practice patterns is also seen in this paper titled Variation in Follow-Up Imaging Recommendations in Radiology Reports, Patient Modalities, and Radiologist Predictions. You see, radiologists, they sometimes say this needs follow-up, and sometimes they say this doesn't need follow-up. Everything in medicine has its own variation, whether it be a pathology report. Yep. Two pathologists will read it differently. Whether it be a lung nodule, yep, two radiologists will read that lung nodule differently. Well, in this study, researchers analyzed over 300,000 radiologist reports to assess the variability in the follow-up. How often were they saying, hey, you should definitely follow up? And how often were they saying, eh, that probably doesn't need followed up. You're good to go. Don't worry about it. In the end, there was a huge amount of variability. When we're talking about musculoskeletal, there were follow-up rates anywhere from 6 to 29%. We're talking about neuroradiology, follow-up rates anywhere from 5 to 29%. Emergency medicine, oh, follow-up rates varied 3 to 17. Now, because of the Fleischner criteria, that is almost standardized. Almost standardized, you would say, except for in chest radiologists, the need for follow-up varied from 1 to 2%. So still not standard, but a lot more than normal. I think it just depends on how much coffee has the radiologist had? How late were they up with their kid the night before? Are they hedging their bets? Are they saying, no, I'm feeling pretty confident in what I'm seeing today? I don't think there's a good answer to this. I think it's just worth knowing that, like all things in medicine, nothing is constant. Nothing is a solid, gung-ho, this is an absolute 100% prediction, because there is a variability. There's a confidence interval that surrounds everything, including radiology reports. And maybe one of the last things I want to talk about before I wrap this up is the new guidelines that Joe and I just recently podcasted on for Right on Prime, the MRAP edition of primary care. It's the GYNA or the GINA or the GYNA guidelines, the Global Initiative for Asthma Report, updated 2019. Now, the reason I want to talk about it is because that has been a long time coming, a long, long time coming, that we have actually had anything exciting in the management of asthma. I mean, we can go back almost 50 years now, and you're going to be saying, when it comes to the management of asthma, you should give a SABA, 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 SABA. You know what I'm talking about, the short-acting beta antagonist. First-line treatment for asthma. Well, not any longer, my friends. The times, oh, the times they are a-changing. That is right. No longer is the correct answer SABA when we're talking about better asthma control. These new fresh-off-the-press guidelines actually have you using Symbacort. Now, I know Symbacort is the trade name. I know that that's not what you're actually going to use. You're actually going to write for the drug budesonide formoterol. But it's easy to say Symbacort, and it makes it simple when you write for Symbacort, budesonide formoterol, budesonide formoterol. See, because that is Symbacort. Symbacort makes it simple. They go together just like that, and it is the first line PRN dosing for asthma control. As a reminder, category one or step one of asthma care, this is the category for those individuals with symptoms 2 or fewer days per week and no interference with the activities of your daily living, including sleep interruptions from asthma. Again, normally we would say SABA, but not any longer. It is now PRN. Yes, that is right. PRN Symbacort. It is PRN budesonide and formoterol. This comes from indirect evidence from the BEST, the TREXA, and the BASALT trials. And if you are one of those individuals that is saying, but I have to give the SABA, I don't know what to do with my life if I don't give the SABA, the guidelines also say that if you are going to give the PRN SABA, if you're going to write for the, hey, here's your albuterol that you've been having every single day for the last 54 years because we haven't changed the guidelines in that long. Now, if you're going to write just for the PRN SABA, you also need to write for PRN inhaled corticosteroids to go with it. So long gone are the days that even now, if you just want to write for albuterol, you only want to write for albuterol. No. Not according to the guidelines now. According to the guidelines now, it's either PRN, SABA plus inhaled corticosteroid, or PRN, inhaled corticosteroid, and formoterol. Now, that was step one asthma care, but now let's move on to step two asthma care, the beginning of persistent asthma. This is the individuals with symptoms more than 2 days a week, but not daily, and 1 to 2 times a month they have their sleep interrupted because of their asthma. So again, in step one, we did PRN, inhaled corticosteroid, and formoterol. And in step two, it's PRN, inhaled corticosteroid, and formoterol. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. The options don't change between one and two. You automatically jump into option two. That is because the trial, the biggest trial that we have here that looked at this, enrolled individuals that were eligible for step two therapy, and that those individuals were randomized to either inhaled corticosteroid LABA or to the twice daily inhaled corticosteroid group compared to then just the as needed SABA. They found that the scheduled inhaled corticosteroids actually did have better symptom relief compared to the SABAs. But when we're looking at hospitalizations, when we're looking at severe exacerbations, there was no difference between the twice daily inhaled corticosteroids and the PRN, inhaled corticosteroids, and LABAs. And if you have a PRN drug that does just as well as a twice daily drug, then it is only reasonable and it is only logical that you would then give the PRN medication, because the PRN medication is likely to have much better compliance than the twice daily medication. So to refresh, the new guidelines, this new GINA guidelines, PRN, inhaled corticosteroid, and formoterol is now the go-to first-line, here-we-are treatment for step one and step two asthma therapy. And when you move to step three therapy, instead of being PRN, it is now scheduled. It is unbelievably simple. Almost like there was a drug that we could say would be simple. To help us remember that there is a new change in asthma. Oh, there is a new change. This is game changing for everyone. Simple, kind of like budesonide for Motorol. Budesonide for Motorol. Budesonide for Motorol. And for that, let's wrap this like we've ended every podcast before it. So in 30 seconds or less, let's try to recap all the articles we've been over so far. Article number one, even though we don't know where the stroke is coming from, it's an ischemic stroke, we have no idea where it's coming from, aspirin is still the king over pure anticoagulation. After all these years, aspirin is still king, and it is such a king, it is such a king of its crown, that even if you have a spontaneous brain bleed, a spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage, it does appear safe to restart this king after 2 to 3 month break. But unfortunately, we don't know what to do with anticoagulations because the study didn't look at that. On to the next one. It was the smart choice in the stop DAPT-2 trial. Smart Choice looked at 3 months compared to 12 months of DAPT, and boom, bada bing, wouldn't you know. But let's not stop there. Let's look at 1 month versus 12 month. After doing the 1 month of dual antiplatelet, you then moved to monotherapy clopidogrel, and wouldn't you know it, it did better than 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy. Bada boom, bada bing, winner, winner, chicken dinner. That is game-changing, game-practice-changing. That is guideline-changing. You need to know about that one. Go back and re-listen to it, because that is it. The STOP-DAP2 trial. Put it into your memory bank. Now, all of medicine has variation. Some primary care doctors will give antibiotics for otitis media, and some will read literature and not give antibiotics. Some radiologists will say you need to follow up, and some will say you don't. The variability on this is wide-ranging. I think it is important just to be aware of, just to know, and important to educate your patients about. Now, last but not least, another game-changing, practice-changing, life-altering paper. That is, of course, new guidelines on asthma from the Global Initiative for Asthma that says no more, ever, never, ever, 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 never, never gonna get it. Never gonna get it. Solo albuterol, PRN, for those individuals with asthma. Nope, no more. Now, when you think that you're gonna write for albuterol, PRN, you are now going to write for budesonide, formoterol, PRN. It is simple. It is so simple. That you should always be able to remember. Budesonide, formoterol, PRN. That is the new go-to. There you have it. There it is. Now, let's wrap this one up like we have wrapped up everyone before. Stop, take a break, wait for the music. And there we go. There you have it. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.